Well, hello and welcome back to the co-op. Here we are with episode 3. Very excited to make it this far. Thanks to everyone who has listened to us so far, downloaded the podcast and supported. Before we get started, I do want to put out that reminder. Please do consider signing up to be a premium member. It's $9.99 a month, and doing so, you get some good discounts and some good deals from our advertisers, and you'll be helping Rebecca and I go a long way, help us spread our message, help us grow the platform, and so that'd be great. So if you guys, anyone wants to subscribe, you can follow the link on our Podbean page. There should be a link there for you to subscribe, and we would appreciate that, and that would be awesome. So, Rebecca, how are you doing? What's up?
Yeah. Oh, I'm doing great. You know, I've come to that point where I look at the news every day and I start laughing,
yeah.
Which is better than the way it was last year when I looked at the news and just started drinking. So, yeah, you know, a spirit of comedy, dark comedy, can sustain us all through these times.
You have to. I think you pretty much have to be... look at things in a bit of a comedic way, or at least take an absurdist standpoint with it because of how ridiculous everything has gotten. It's just one thing after the other. I do want to talk about something to start off with, though, about ridiculousness because of what's going on in Alabama right now and how it actually kind of relates to abortion and the new pro-life movement in general, but also just to kind of give you an idea of what the hell is happening down here, because it's really insane. For those who, if you've been following the news at all about with the changes in Senate seats and everything, then you know that, you know, Alabama is in the middle of a special election. The Democrats are running a guy named Doug Jones, who, for all intents and purposes, is a really stand-up guy. He was a lawyer. He has helped put the people who were behind the 16th Street church bombing in the 60s, put those Klansmen behind bars. He's had a long career. He's been great. And he's got a wonderful platform, and really, honestly, he's a moderate, and he's got all this great across the aisle appeal. The other guy is a guy named Roy Moore, who is one of the most terrifying politicians ever, I think. He is insanely homophobic, insanely Islamophobic. He's extremely pro-gun in the most extreme sense. He is not going to do any good for this country whatsoever. He has been removed from office in Alabama twice. He was a chief justice, and he was removed twice because he can't perform his job properly. The first time he was removed because he erected a huge Ten Commandments monument in the Alabama courthouse, and that was a major violation of the separation of church and state, and so he was forced down. The second time, he was put down because of his... he refused to basically follow the federal direction that people could now, homosexual couples could get married. He was extreme. Extreme opponent of same-sex marriage and rights for our fellow homosexual brothers and sisters, many of whom who also make up a good deal of this pro-life network. And so I say all that to then kind of bring all that around to understand that, like, what we have here is this this very obvious choice. Roy Moore is very much the worst possible person that could be in office. There are plenty of Republicans in Alabama that don't want to vote for him, and Doug Jones, up until about 3 days ago, looked like he was just this shining star, this great, wonderful, gives the Democrats hope because they might be able to elect someone out of their party to statewide office for the first time. He's this moderate. He's got this great platform. He's got this appeal across the aisle. And then he gave this interview and did the stupidest thing he could have possibly done, and that was come down really hard in favor of abortion and opposing the 20-week ban. It was honestly heartbreaking because I didn't expect him to... I didn't expect him to be necessarily pro-life, or at least from an ideological perspective of being anti-abortion. I didn't really expect that, but I certainly thought that maybe someone as smart as him, or who's supposed to be as smart as him, who has such this great but fragile opportunity to really change the game in both the Senate and in Alabama, would come down so hard, like who wouldn't even try to brand it a little bit differently. And has now put this at the forefront of his campaign, which has given Roy Moore all the ammunition he possibly needs to run with, and was pretty much going to ensure that any of those Republican votes that he was relying on to win are probably just at this point, I'm afraid, are going to stay at home. And so I think that it's funny to me, though, because that theme, tell that whole story, but it's funny to me because so much of everything I just described has a lot to do with some of the frustrations that we as the movement, the new pro-life movement, kind of find ourselves facing with both the right and the left. Roy Moore is going to bill himself as a pro-life candidate, but he is in no way, shape, or form a pro-life individual, other than the fact that he's opposed to abortion. Doug Jones almost certainly supports a number of social policies that we think would go a long way to reducing the root causes of abortion, and that's fantastic. But at the same time, he and every other Democrat, I think, and Rebecca, I want to get your opinion on this too. Every other Democrat, by coming down so hard on in favor of abortion rights, and especially I think by opposing the 20-week ban that's currently making its way through the legislation, which is almost certainly going to die in the Senate as well. By opposing that, the Democrats are just continuously feeding into this narrative that they're abortion extremists, and in a lot of ways, I mean, they really kind of are. I think in this sense, with opposing the 20-week ban. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I want to give a little background on this because we actually published something about the 20-week ban recently. It's what I think just about anyone would consider to be an incredibly moderate piece of legislation, and it's actually phrased as the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. So what we're looking at is something that you don't have to believe in the personhood of the unborn child or absolute equal rights of the unborn child in order to be that what we have here is a living organism who should not be made to suffer. And so this bill would protect the unborn after that point. So this is not some kind of radically anti-woman legislation. This is not, abortions tend not to happen very frequently at this kind of a late date. And if they are happening, it's usually because of dire circumstances, and the bill actually makes an allowance for those.
Indeed.
Like, this is a bill that a lot of pro-lifers wouldn't think is tough enough. It would just kind of put us in line with Europe. If we had in place a law like this, plus the kind of social programs and the social safety nets that we've been advocating, what we would have is something much closer to what is considered ordinary in most of the developed world. Not some kind of radically socialist thing, nor would it be some kind of radically anti-abortion thing. So, you know, this is your chance for people to come across the aisle and hold hands and, you know, sing Kumbaya if they really want to. So, yeah, it's frustrating because this whole scenario is like what you've been describing, Matthew. I'm listening to it, and I'm like, well, yeah, we've seen that one before.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen, you know, you've got the politician you really want to support, and then that politician comes out and says something, and, you know, all your pro-life friends are sending you messages and saying, you know, can you still support so-and-so after what he said? And, yeah, just putting us in a position where we feel shamed, publicly shamed for endorsing a politician. And as you say, Matthew, like, how can they be so stupid when they seem so smart in other ways?
Yeah. And what kills me, too, is, I mean, you're right. And let's just be honest, you know, about this, too. I want to make one thing really, really clear. I fully and truly believe that Doug Jones is still the right person for the job, because I know a few things to be true. I know that, one, like, it doesn't matter if Roy Moore or Doug Jones goes to the Senate. Nothing, as I've said, we said it plenty of times before, nothing anytime soon is going to get done about abortion in this country. It's still going to be legal. It's still going to be legal. It's Roe versus Wade is still going to be there. Donald Trump has been president for getting close to a year now, as crazy as that seems.
Yep.
He's getting close to a year now. And he has had, well, the Republicans have had a majority for years at this point, but he has had the executive office. He has, and the Republicans have control of both houses of Congress. Hell, Republicans have control. Republicans have the majority of state legislatures.
Of everything.
And the majority of governorships. They have the control of everything. There's no reason from the way that they talk about it. There's no reason. This is exactly what they told everybody, every pro-lifer out there, this is what you need to do. This is the scenario we need to be in order for us to do something about abortion. And they've had almost a year, and you need to tell me they haven't been able to get anything done about it. And I know that when Congress wants to, when they want to, they can get bills through. When any body of legislation wants to get legislation through, they'll get it through. The Alabama state government is notorious for that, because they are terrible at passing decent legislation. But as soon as something comes up that the Republican supermajority down here doesn't like, they'll get a bill passed within a week. They'll get it written out of committee and passed within a week in both houses. So something can be done about it. It's just that they're not going to, because they were never going to. The Republicans were never going to get rid of abortion. It's not going to happen. At least not now and not anytime soon, because there's too much other stuff in place that's prohibiting them from doing that. So I know that truth to be one thing. And I know that Doug Jones isn't going to go in there and suddenly going to, you know, increase the abortion rate by crazy amounts just for the malicious point of killing babies. As a matter of fact, the thing, as I said before, the thing that Doug Jones supports, and the thing that a lot of Democrats support, and the reason that I still work with Democrats and am very much involved with, you know, Democrats for Life, is because all the other work they're going to do is, I think goes into helping fight those root causes, where all the other work that a lot of the GOP tends to do goes into agitating those root causes that cause women to, you know, to have an abortion. So I still think Doug Jones is the right man for the job for all of those reasons there. I really truly do believe that. But it does bother me that Democrats can't seem to see how much of an extremist position they do take, even if it's just a philosophical one. Because like you said, the rest of the developed world isn't as crazy. We talk all the time. We give all this kind of crap about secular Europe and how terrible secular Europe is, and yet they're the ones making sure that all their people have health care. A lot of those countries are making sure that their workers are well paid and making sure that they're fed. And then a lot of those places don't allow elective abortions after 20 weeks. A lot of them don't allow abortions after 12 weeks, for what it's worth.
Oh, yeah, I think there's a connection between those two phenomena, that they don't have the same clamor for abortion because the women know that they're not going to be as desperate as we are here in the land of the free. I think that's really significant. So, this idea that there's some kind of a secular humanist thing, it's just not a Catholic idea. Like, whatever it is that they're posing as a religious alternative to secular Europe is not what we who are following Catholic social teaching recognize as anything profoundly religious.
Like you mentioned earlier, very few abortions are actually done past 20 weeks, and this bill already makes room for abortions, and if the life of the mother is in danger or rape or incest or, you know, all those regular exemptions we always put into this kind of thing. And so again, it's an extremely vanilla.
Right.
It's so vanilla that it's really working, I think, as a trap. Because I mean, the Republicans can have a field day with this. They can have a field day that says that look, we put forward this pro-life bill that had a lot of give to it. You know, we banned it after only 20 weeks. We didn't go after first trimester abortions. We made exceptions. We're not prosecuting the women. The only people that can be prosecuted under this bill would
right.
be the
That's
doctors
important.
That would perform it. Like, they've done a lot to, I think personally, and I can't really don't even like giving Republicans credit for anything. And of course, I will say that it did have pro-life Democrat support, all two of them in the House, but there were two pro-life Democrats that did work on this bill as well. And so maybe that's why it's more appealing. But it really is a vanilla bill that by opposing the Democrats make themselves look like extremists, and that is not going to do anything to help anything, because people like Roy Moore are going to use it in their campaign, and they're going to keep people who would otherwise help address a lot of the social stressors that we're always talking about that lead women to abortion from ever getting into office in the first place.
Yeah, and that's like, if we're not even thinking about the abortion issue, if we're thinking in terms of the resistance, the resistance being right now, any sane person who doesn't want more Trump, and that can be, some Republicans, that can be American Solidarity Party, that can be pro-life Democrats, that can be radical leftist independent people like myself. We need to be able to stick together during this time, and that's one of the beauties of our new pro-life platform, is that it's very much about bridge building when possible.
Exactly.
You can't build a bridge to everyone, but you can build an awful lot of bridges. It's amazing what we can do if we are willing to work together.
And it really does put people into extremist camps, and it kills me. This is the most divisive issue in the world, in our country. I mean, it really is, and it's interesting to me to watch how it, how it keeps people who otherwise really need to be working together from working together. And as like Rebecca said, this movement is all about trying to build bridges with as many people as possible. That includes pro-choice people. I think we're one
right.
of the few pro-life movements or communities that wants to actually work with pro-choice people, because we have to realize that at the end of the day, it's like we said before, at the end of the day, we need there to be a sustainable something sustainable to help keep abortion rates down. We need there to be it needs to be sustained by social factors. Like we said, if we just get rid of it right now, it is going to reduce the abortion rate, because like we said in our first episode, abortions aren't going to be reported as much as they would be now, and some people they will have the baby. But there's so much more to consider here, as far as what are we going to do about those women who are in crisis pregnancies, and, what are we going to do about all these other issues that a woman might, feel compelled to abort to begin with, and we have to address that, and we can't address those issues unless everyone, pro-life and pro-choice, are somehow finding a way to meet in the middle and work on this kind of stuff. It's a long
right.
game. I think that's the big deal. I think that's
right.
the thing. Too many people want this to be over tomorrow. They want to elect Trump. They want to get a conservative justice, and they want that justice to immediately go in and do something that he's not even allowed to do somehow, and just magically overturn Roe versus
right.
Wade. And that's just right. not how it's going to happen. And we're going to have to get used to the idea and to the fact that we're going to have to learn to work together, and we're going to have to learn to start thinking outside the box as other ways that we can prevent abortion. And I think, I guess maybe that's a really good segue point to kind of talk about the second thing we want to talk about today.
Yes, yes.
Not
absolutely.
100% related, because...
it's related. It is.
Yeah, it's related. It is. But one of the big contentious issues between pro-life groups, especially between people who are Catholic and who are not Catholic, is what are we going to do about you know, if we're going to talk about helping prevent abortions, then we have to talk about preventing crisis pregnancies. Mm-hmm. And how are we going to work about preventing crisis pregnancies? And some people say, well, we need to just do virtue alone, which has not and will never work. Or maybe there are some other things like the contraception issue. And that brings up a whole new world of debate, which we have kind of just kind of circled back up a little bit recently on Facebook a bit, and that's the old you know the love story and the romance with natural family planning in a lot of Catholic circles.
Right. Yeah, this has been a kind of a big, you know, if you're on Facebook, you may have noticed Catholic Facebook has been discussing this a lot. And it does connect with the other issue because we're talking about pro-life measures that are going to not only get the baby born, but get the baby taken care of for its entire life. And a lot of families right now are looking at a situation in which they're thinking, well, you know, we're barely getting by with the four children that we have, or with the 10 children that we have, or with the one child that we have. You know, how are we going to care for another child? And so, you know, just given economic instability and I think for immigrant families or for people of color or for people who experience much greater social instability, these questions are more profound than I even realize. You know, I've experienced a crisis pregnancy. I've known what it's like to be like, oh my gosh, how am I going to care for this child? And feeling that I have no one to turn to, feeling like there's a lot of beautiful rhetoric out there, but none of it gives me, you know, what I need for right this minute. So that being taken into consideration, you know, we have to take seriously the stories that we're hearing from women, from married couples, from men, because it's primarily a question that has to do with the female body, but it absolutely affects men as well. All of these very true, sometimes painful accounts of just how difficult NFP has been. NFP, mm-hmm. It was supposed to be so beautiful. It was supposed to solve all of their problems. It was spoken of in poetic language. And, you know, 10 years on down the line, some people are saying, yeah, it's great. Or they're saying, well, you know, it's hard, but life is hard. And I imagine that's kind of like a workout, you know, lifting weights for 45 minutes. Yeah, it's a little hard, but it's worth it. There's a difference between that and feeling like you're being bludgeoned repeatedly. And so a lot of the people who've been speaking out are the ones who, you know, it's not just been like weightlifting or running a treadmill, working a late night. It's been more like repeated bludgeoning. And these are the stories we need to listen to.
And let me say, before I say anything else on this matter, let me make one thing really, really clear here. Rebecca and I are not priests. We're not bishops. We're not theologians. We're not apologists.
Right.
We have no authority here. We're not sitting here about to go into necessarily challenging the church teaching on anything, nor are we going to want to sit here and tell you what you should or shouldn't do, regardless of how you feel about it. We just feel like these are the kind of discussions that need to be had, and especially that it's okay to air frustration. I mean, I'll be the first one to tell you that I've completely fallen out of love with the idea of NFP and even church teaching on contraception in general. It's just something that the more I have tried to make sense of it and the more I've tried to, really, the more you try to unwrap it and understand it, to me, the more it falls apart. And there are people out there that can't understand how you could possibly come to that conclusion. You can't understand how you could possibly go, oh, my God, are you kidding me? The church is so thorough in their thinking and their theology and their philosophy. And don't get me wrong. I do think that the church is thorough in all of those situations. I just think that when it comes to the application of this teaching, something somewhere isn't working. There's a clog in the drain somewhere. And for me, in my personal frustrations, is that is that there's so much in church teaching that refers to your conscience, and there's so much about it. And this is one area, and I'm not talking about the freedom to use contraception whenever you want to. I'm not talking about being in a relationship that is 100% closed to the idea, of ever procreating. I'm not talking about I'm not talking about fornication. I'm not talking about sleeping around. I'm not talking about any of these other issues. I'm not talking about using contraception as a means of liberation for people to have as much sex as they want to. That's not what we're talking about here. And let me say, that gets brought up way too much when we're talking about these issues. I'm talking about married couples who have children, who are struggling to get through a situation, who cannot for the life of them, whether it's because of a medical issue or whether it's a mental issue, a mental health issue or something, who are terrified of getting pregnant again, mm-hmm. who simply cannot just be okay with this idea that, yes, just use NFP, but just remain open to life at all times, and if you get pregnant, it'll be this wonderful. No, in some situations, you don't need to get pregnant. You don't. And yet, it doesn't work for everybody. It gets touted as this wonderful, great, and awesome thing. And for some people, it is. For some people, it does not work. It does not work for them. And for some people, they can't risk it. They can't just be, I'm open to life. They can't just be like that because of a medical reason or specific reason. And so, to kind of pull this all back and kind of explain a little bit of what I'm getting at, I'm not even sitting here saying that the church needs to release this, like Pope Francis needs to come out and say, okay, so this teaching only applies in these situations and in these extreme situations, it's okay. I don't think that would be good. I think what needs to happen is that we need to rely more as faithful Catholics who are seeking God and who are truly open to what God has to tell them and who are seriously, struggling with an issue. I think we need to, in those situations and in all situations, need to allow the laity to rely a little bit more on their God-given conscience, to let this married couple rely on their conscience between the two of them and between their time with God and make a decision that is best for their relationship based off of that situation. I just want to see a little bit more faith in people's conscience. And I know that sounds like such a humanistic thing to say, and people are gonna may not like that, and I don't really care if you don't like that, to be honest with you. I think the way that we're approaching it is in a lot of times hurting people, because you're just telling them, just trust God. Well, sometimes I don't believe in a super duper interventionist God. Sometimes you need God to show up and he doesn't. And I don't know why, but that's just what it is. And sometimes you can't rely on that. And there has to be room made for it, I think.
You can't rely on it at all. I mean, the history of Christianity and Judaism, I'm Jewish as well as Catholic, which is fun because all of the anti-Semites like to attack me. But, I come from a history of people who called out to God repeatedly and nothing happened. And, in many cases, we continued to hold on to that faith, but it's not a faith in, Santa Claus, Jesus. It's not a Joel Osteen God. It's a God who's kind of hidden in the shadows, and we turned to him in our darkest hour, but not because he's going to save us. He's not going to give us the job we need. He's not going to give you the new car. He's not going to cure you of cancer. These things might happen, but there's no guarantee. And I personally don't believe it's because of divine intervention. Why would God intervene to get one guy a new car while somewhere in another part of the world all of his children are being slaughtered in genocide?
Exactly.
So this providentialist thing is—it's so American, it's so white bread, it's so white privilege.
Extremely white privilege. That's what it is.
Yeah, yeah. So blessed. I think we need to take serious. I think we actually just need to push aside that whole nonsense. Like, if you come talking nonsense to us about how God is going to provide, then I'm just not listening. I'm not interested. It makes no sense. Let's talk about other questions which are more relevant, which is, how much suffering are we called to bear And should marriage be the source of that suffering? Because there's this whole, like, you know, well, marriage is a beautiful sacrament, and there's this whole business about how, like, happily married Catholics have the best sex of all. I don't know how they're figuring this out. Like,
I don't either.
Who's going around to... I'm not sure I want to know.
I have
it might
not
be
taken
a funny novel.
Oh.
But, like, are they hooking married couples up to, like, machines that determine... I don't know. Oh, so that's one narrative, and that's the narrative you get beforehand. And then later, when you're like, wow, oh, all these people are saying, you know, this isn't what I signed up for. And then what they're hearing in return is, well, no one said Christianity was going to be easy.
We're
supposed to take up our cross. And, yeah, we are supposed to take up our cross, but I think isn't our cross... supposed to be forgiving our enemies and turning the other cheek? Is it supposed to be an actual sacrament of the church? Because marriage is a sacrament, and if the sacrament of the church is supposed to be the source of suffering, I feel like that's just a little bit off.
Absolutely.
I feel like we've gone into some kind of weird nihilism here.
I have a hard time really believing that it's supposed to be, that, like you said, it's supposed to be this absolute source of suffering. Like, and there are plenty of Christian denominations out there that believe in this just depraved idea of God and his relationship to humanity. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to believe in that. I'm not going to do it. You can't make me. I'm not going to believe in that type of God. I'm not going to believe in a God that is that craven, that he can't understand what these people are going through. They can't understand what a married couple is going through, that if they do fall to temptation, or if they make a decision that they deem is best for their marriage, because that's something else that we don't talk about enough, is how difficult this stuff is, the childbearing and NFP and all this stuff, how difficult that actually is on a marriage. And people will say, again, they'll go back to, well, you just got to trust God, and there's God in the center of your marriage. And that's I'm just called bullshit on that. It's not realistic, and I don't think it's relevant or realistic to the way that God works in our lives to begin with. This just fairy tale, happy go lucky nonsense that it's what marriage is difficult, and it's work, and it's wonderful, and it's amazing, but it is difficult. Yes, that is all very, very true. But when you have people who are saying NFP is ruining my marriage, it is causing so much strain between me and my spouse. Mm-hmm. You know, and if your response to that is, well, I'm sorry, trust God, and too bad, if it's not working for you, then you just can't have sex until you decide you want to have another baby. No, I'm sorry. Yeah. That's not how it works, and you're stupid if you think that that's how it's going to work. I'm sorry. This whole conversation frustrates me to no end. But what I think really... we as Catholics, as lay Catholics, as people who aren't making the rules and calling the shots, can do in the meantime, whether anything ever happens, who knows? I'm not here to speculate on whether or not anything's going to change. I'm not even advocating necessarily for change. But the one thing that we as Catholics, I think, can do is, like we said at the beginning, is be more open and honest about these conversations. And I'll tell you this too. If a married couple is going through an issue where they can't get pregnant again, you know, and if they between they themselves and God work it out, and they decide that, okay, maybe we're going to use condoms for a month, you don't say a word to them about it. You stay out of their business, and you do not lambast them, and you do not lament them, and you do not yell at them and make them feel like they're ungrateful, imperfect Catholics, because I swear to you that shit will push people out of the church faster than any amount of condoms ever could.
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that we've come back to this a question about, like, practically making a marriage work has brought us to this question of the nature of God. You know, is God this Santa Claus God who's going to give you everything you want if you just follow his rules? No, he's not. But neither is he this creepy, sadistic God who's like rubbing his hands together while he watches us suffer, and he's like, suffer more. My son's suffering wasn't enough. So, you know, right. And both of those are so American, too.
Oh,
so
yeah.
What I think we need to kind of keep to the forefront a more correct theology of the divine Jesus is really good at holding out to us. And, you know, God isn't going to give us everything we want, but neither is God going to punish us for failing, especially when what we're trying to do is essentially good. This is not a case in which we're talking about people who are out there just having wild promiscuous sex and rushing off to have abortions so they can have more wild promiscuous sex. We're talking people who have children, who have loving marriages, who are often living lives of service to the community and to the church. And to say about these people that they are in some kind of gravely mortal sin, worse than slavery, I run into the most bizarre conversations.
Oh,
because as soon as people have posited this incredible evil of contraception, then they've created a scenario in which other things, they say, well, aren't really quite that evil. So, you know, shooting someone, as others have pointed out, we have a principle of double effect according to which you can do that and get away with it, and that ties in with last week's conversation about guns. We've got all these people who are like, yes, when do I get to shoot someone? I really hope someone breaks into my house so I can kill him. Oh, and this is somehow better than the loving couple who has children and just for whatever reason, you know, sometimes really serious reasons. Like, I've talked to women who said their doctors told them they would die if they got pregnant again. And in that case, you know, to condemn a couple who uses a condom for a few times. Now, again, as you said, Matthew, we're not the magisterium. We're not here to attack church teaching. What we want to do is ask what the possibilities are for looking at the existing doctrine and looking at the way in which we talk and seeing what can be done. What can we do for people who are trying so hard and having terrible burdens put upon them?
And I do think Pope Francis is honestly, I'm not one to sit here and say that Pope Francis is going to change church teaching. I don't believe that. And I think it's really hard for people to really kind of understand, because it is not necessary. We're not talking about a black and white issue, and I think so many people want it to be a black and white issue, and it just can't be. And I think Pope Francis is trending. I really do think he's trending more into that area of the church is right, but there needs to be room for the individual's conscience to play into terms. It's like I think I kind of relate to it what Father Martin said about changing this church language regarding like homosexuality from, you know, changing it to something different than just disordered, because it's not very pastoral and it's not a good descriptor. And I agree with Father Martin. You know, of course, there's plenty of people out there that think that, you know, oh, Father Martin's trying to change church teaching, and you know, and we're big supporters of Father Martin.
Other people say he's not changing it enough. Yeah.
Right, exactly. I know, but I think it's kind of in that same realm. It's like there's got to be some room made for the individual conscience in these situations, and it's not a matter, like you said, it's not a matter of saying we need a list of exceptions. It's a matter of saying we need to feel okay with, because what if I'm truly searching God, I'm truly searching these answers, and I keep coming back to my conscience is telling me that there's another way I can do this, that this is not, it's a murky area. It is a murky area. I admit that it's a very murky area. It's not black and white, but I don't advocate for the black and white. I advocate for the gray, because I think that most everything is just a big mush of gray. Doesn't mean it's relative. I don't think that it's all relative, but I do think it's very much something that there needs to be room for the conscience and issues on a case-by-case basis. And I'll close, or at least for me, because I've been ranting a lot, you know, kind of with a final thought. And it's that we can't tell you what to do. If you're struggling with NFP in your marriage, if you're struggling with these church teachings, I can't tell you what to do, and I can't give you any kind of direction, but I can tell you that you can take solace in the fact that you are certainly not alone, and that it's okay to be pissed off at God, and it's okay to be pissed off at the church, and it's okay to break the rules sometimes. It's okay to mess up. I'm not saying go against the church, but I'm saying you're a sinner, and you're going to screw up, and it's okay to doubt, and you're imperfect, and that's okay, too. And you need to strive to do your best. You do. If you want to be a faithful Catholic, you do need to strive to do your best. But you need to understand that it's okay to fall, and it's okay to make a mistake, and it's okay to doubt, and it's okay to be angry, and it's okay to take your own, go off on your own little tangent every once in a while. You know, sometimes that can be healthy for the faith. I think the one thing that needs to be said, one of the things, is that we have to remember that God made us, God understands us, and we need to remember more of that. I think we need to remember more of the fact that God gets it. I don't believe in a jerk, you know, of a God that's just standing up there with his arms crossed and just as being this big, oh, well, you didn't follow all my rules to a T, even though you were a great person, even though you did everything else you're supposed to do. You didn't follow all my rules to a T, and so therefore you're in hell. No, I'm sorry. I'm not buying it. I'm not believing in it. Right. It's just not what it is.
And that's why we have the life of the sacraments, too, which
exactly.
is really so much more at the heart of the church. I feel like we forget that the sacraments are where we find the real presence of God. And that's a lot more a genuine encounter with the divine than anything that's been put into human language, because the nature of human language is that it is inevitably ambiguous. So we're trying to work with ambiguous human language. And that's why I say, you know, let's look at what's possible. Let's look at what can be done. And above all, please, if you are a person for whom this works, or if you're a person who has authority, just take a moment to listen and remember that another person's experiences are not yours, and you will never understand them. That what may have been easy for you may be intolerable for others. And that's why we need to have this, you know, as you say, Matthew, this gray area, because there is such a thing as objective material evil, but there's also culpability. There's also what can a person bear? What does a person know? So, yes, please listen, and please be willing to extend mercy before judgment. I ask all of you.
Well, that is going to do it for us. Thank you again so much for tuning in. Please remember to become a premium member, if you will, $9.99 a month, and you can help us grow our platform and get our message out there to more people. Thanks always for tuning in, and we will see you next time.